Hello, everyone. Welcome to the reading of the Ford Dodge Messenger. We're reading from the editions of Friday, March 19th and Saturday, March 20th. I'm Kevin Rogers at your microphone. Coming to you late Sunday afternoon. The clouds are moving in, the wind is picking up, and we're expecting rain in the Fort Dodge area, according to the forecast I saw, at least Monday, Tuesday, and possibly Wednesday. But we'll take a look at a more in-depth forecast as we close our time together. In the meantime, we have lots of things to talk about today. Finding the Answers will be the first article that I read. In one moment, Amanda Holmes might be fielding questions from city employees about payroll, and in the next moment, she might be answering a resident's question about junk days on social media. Holmes is the city human resources and communications specialist. She's used to finding the answers to a wide variety of questions. Holmes spends much of her time sending out press releases and responding to people's concerns on social media. I want to get people an answer, she said, even if it's not the answer you want to hear. I want people to know they have been heard. Holmes, a native of Sioux City, has lived in Fort Dodge since 2006. She worked at Heartland Communications Group before accepting a job with the city in November 2016. Holmes, who holds a bachelor's degree in business from the University of South Dakota, started with the city as an equal employment opportunity specialist. As she continued to take on more communication tasks for title change, that was in 2019. She also served as the human rights director for Fort Dodge Human Rights Commission. When the COVID-19 pandemic changed the world 1 year ago in March, many people found themselves without work or had their work slowed down. That was not the case for Holmes. The joke around the office is that HR was really the only department that ended up busier after COVID hit, Holmes said. We were making policy changes weekly and changing guidances as often as the CDC was putting it out. It forced us in a short period of time to look at our processes. She never anticipated the doors to the municipal building closing for an extended period of time. If you told me we were going to shut down City Hall for 3 or 4 months, I would have laughed, she said. That's exactly what happened. We had to transition to doing business different than we have done it since, said Holmes. There are people that come in every month to pay their water bills, so there were decisions to waive credit card fees, and that was a whole new layer of communicating out to the public. The public library, Blanda Memorial Art Museum, and city parks closed, too. It was a very weird time, and it feels like it was forever ago, Holmes said. It's crazy to think it's just been the one-year anniversary. Meetings have been conducted differently to allow the public to have a voice during the pandemic. We moved to the Zoom webinar, which is how we do it now, where the council is on the panel, Holmes said. If people want to comment, they can raise their hand. Holmes believes Zoom is here to stay regardless of how the pandemic plays out. Even when we come back to the chambers in person, I would like to continue in a hybrid format, she said. The more people you have, even if they are just listening and being informed, it all helps to quell the rumor mill or that all the city money has gone to potholes. I believe the more educated the citizens are, the more they understand why we do what we do. She believes more residents have been engaged because of the addition of Zoom. It's made it easier for her to listen in as well. There's a lot of nights I'm home making supper and listening to the council meeting in the background, Holmes said. Mayor Matt Bremrick was complimentary of Holmes's effort throughout the past year. Amanda wears multiple hats, Bremrick said. She has almost become a public relations liaison. People are following the city's Facebook page more. She's done a great job. One positive during the pandemic was most city employees remained healthy. We were lucky that our employees stayed pretty healthy, she said. They may not have liked everything we put into place. We transitioned a lot of employees to working from home. We still have a few, but most people are back. The next step is making sure employees get vaccinated. Right now, it's all about getting people in to get vaccinated, Holmes said. Our police and fire have all been vaccinated, so now it's just our employees with pre-existing conditions we are working to get in to get vaccinated. We have worked closely with Webster County Public Health through the pandemic. Kelly Bloomquist has been a great support to me. In recent times, the city has streamlined some of its communications on social media. We did some consolidation on Facebook, Holmes said. Public Works had their own page. We were just going to use the City of Fort Dodge page as the main means of communication, they can get that information in one spot. It's nice to have that consistent communication, whether it's Facebook or press releases. On Facebook, Holmes is proud to have earned the badge of Fast Response. Before I started doing the communications, there wasn't any one designated person, so we kind of tag-teamed it among staff, Holmes said. I wanted to get my badge that says Fast Response, the badge that says you respond in a timely manner on Facebook. If they are taking the time to message us, I want to make sure they get a response. Responding to the public isn't always an easy task. The big thing for me is just the courtesy and respect. It would be so easy to just respond to someone and walk away, whether it's an employee or a citizen. I try to follow up. I try to make sure they know we are passing things along or that we have instituted a change based on what they have said or recommended. I think people sometimes forget that there is really a person on the other side of a Facebook page. It's a real person responding. I've been called names. People apologize. It's nothing I haven't heard. Despite some of the stress, Holmes feels like as she's settled in nicely in her role with the city, and she enjoyed living in the community. She has enjoyed, rather, living in the community as well. I love my job, she said. In the 4 or 5 years I've been here, there hasn't been a day that I've dreaded coming to work. That's a testament not only of the culture of the city, but the staff and citizens. She doesn't like when people put down Fort Dodge. Fort Dodge has come a long way since 2006. This is my home. My husband and I have 2 young boys. My oldest will be in TK next year, and we have put down roots. I will defend this city and the stereotypes and the negativity. It's completely what you make it. I don't think I fully understood or appreciated it until I came to the city and see how hard these people work to make Fort Dodge a place they want to live and others want to live. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, a suppression hearing was held recently for the person who is accused of killing the Reverend Alan Henderson. Attorneys for the man accused of killing the Reverend Al Henderson asked a judge Friday to prohibit some of the statements he made to police the night of the alleged murder for being used in the defendant's upcoming trial. According to the motion to suppress, defendant Josh Pendleton, 37, was denied his constitutional rights when law enforcement obtained his statements in violation of the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 14th Amendments of the United States Constitution. Pendleton is accused of killing Henderson in the parking lot of St. Paul Lutheran Church on the evening of October 2, 2019. The motion aims to throw out statements Pendleton made to then-Detective Evan Thompson, Detective Larry Hedlund, and then-Webster County Jailer Sergeant Josh Pyle. According to the defense, when Pendleton was first approached by law enforcement near his residence on 4th Avenue South, shortly after Henderson's body had been found and Pendleton had been identified as a suspect, Thompson started to ask him questions without advising him of his Miranda rights. All defendants in criminal cases must be properly advised of their Miranda rights, including the right to remain silent, the right to an attorney, and that anything they say during interviews with law enforcement can be used against them. The motion to suppress states that Hedlund had, quote, disingenuously told the defendant he wasn't under arrest, but a reasonable person in the defendant's situation would believe that he was not free to go. The motion further alleges that when Hedlund did advise Pendleton of his Miranda rights and Pendleton waived the rights, he did not necessarily do so fully understanding what the waiver meant. The defendant's long history of schizophrenia impaired his mental capacity to the point where it would be impossible to say, quote, his capacity for self-determination was not critically impaired, the motion said. Thompson and Pyle both testified during the hearing on Friday. During cross-examination, defense attorney Michelle Wolf asked Thompson what kind of mental health training he had and if he was qualified to say whether or not Pendleton was undergoing a mental health issue when he interviewed him on October 2nd. Thompson said that the Fort Dodge Police Department receives departmental training in mental health, and he is not qualified to say whether or not Pendleton was experiencing any mental health crisis that night. However, with further questioning from Wolf, Thompson did concede that Pendleton was already known throughout the law enforcement community as someone with mental health issues. Thompson said Pendleton appeared to be coherent and understand the questions asked of him and responded accordingly. However, in a report made by Thompson, Pendleton was speaking with different accents while talking with police. Did you make any attempt to contact a mental health professional during the course of Mr. Pendleton's interactions with law enforcement? Wolf asked Thompson. No, ma'am, was his response. Continuing with her questioning, Wolf asked if Thompson believed Pendleton behaved, quote, completely normally, end quote, during the course of the interrogation. I don't think that he behaved normally, Thompson said. I think he violated social norms, such as speaking in an accent. When Wolf asked what he meant by violated social norms, he said, like acting strange. Are you phrasing it that way because you're hesitant to say it seemed like he was undergoing a mental health episode? Wolf asked. Thompson said no. That was how he observed the interactions with Pendleton that night. When Pendleton was transported to the law enforcement center, he was interviewed by Hedlund, who Wolf said should not have ever been in the room with Pendleton as he had a close personal relationship with the victim. Henderson had been the chaplain for the Fort Dodge Police Department, Webster County Sheriff's Office, Fort Dodge Fire Department, and Iowa State Patrol Post 7. According to the prosecution, even after Pendleton was read his Miranda rights, he continued to, quote, volunteer statements to law enforcement prior to the arrival of any defense attorney. One key statement the defense once suppressed is a response Pendleton had for Pyle when Pyle was booking Pendleton into the Webster County Jail. As part of the booking process, Pyle said the jailer had asked if Pendleton wanted to take a shower, to which Pendleton indicated he had already taken a shower at that point. According to his testimony on Friday, Pyle asked the shower question as a routine part of the booking process, but jailers are not required to ask every inmate if they want a shower when they are initially booked. In addition to the testimony from Thompson and Pyle, the state submitted depositions from Hedlund and Captain Dennis Quinn. Wolf objected to both depositions being included in the resistance to the motion as the burden of proof is on the state. In the closing arguments, Iowa State Assistant Attorney General Douglas Hammerand noted that Miranda rights generally do not apply to the on-the-scene questioning as to the facts surrounding a crime. He also said the statements made by Pendleton after he was Mirandized at the LEC are admissible in court because Pendleton kept reinitiating the interview even after Hedlund told him to stop talking. Wolf argued that Pendleton should have been Mirandized when he was initially detained by law enforcement at his apartment. Just because the officer used the word detained does not mean he was in custody for Miranda purposes, she said. He's searched, he's told he can't leave, he's put in handcuffs and placed in the back of the patrol car and taken to the police station. She also argued that it was, quote, beyond clear that Pendleton was suffering from a mental health episode and was clearly suffering from delusions the night of the incident. District Court Judge Gina Batting said she would make her ruling on the suppression motion by the end of next week. The jury trial for Pendleton's first-degree murder and robbery charges is scheduled to commence April 19th at the Scott County Courthouse in Davenport. The venue for the trial was moved to Scott County by order of the court in July after the defense attorneys raised the concern of extensive pretrial media coverage, possibly impeding the impartiality of the jury pool. Back to the main page of the Messenger. The jury trial of a Fort Dodge man accused of murdering his ex-girlfriend's mother in January 2020 has been postponed after the defendant waived his right to a speedy trial on Friday afternoon. Mark David Russell, age 29, is facing a first-degree murder charge after police say he killed 45-year-old Angela McLeod in her North 14th Street home on January 20, 2020, following an apparent altercation that Fort Dodge police responded to twice. According to the police report of the incident, Russell allegedly struck McLeod at least three times with a golf club, killing her. The trial had originally been scheduled to start Tuesday and continue for about 2 weeks, but prior to a scheduled hearing on the defense's motion in Lamine on Friday afternoon, the defense submitted its waiver of a speedy trial. A motion in Lamine is a tool to limit testimony by keeping witnesses or attorneys from talking in front of the jury about certain matters that are not relevant or otherwise not admissible at trial. During the hearing on Friday, Russell told District Court Judge Angela Doyle that he wished to waive his right to have a jury trial within 90 days of the filing of the trial information, which was filed on March 11th. He said he wanted to continue the trial in order to pursue mental health treatment so that he could better make decisions in his own defense case. Russell has been diagnosed with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and mild depression, and as of Friday was only taking one psychiatric medication, which was to treat his depression. Defense attorney Charles Kenvell said that Russell has not expressed any active symptoms of mental illness to him or his co-counsel Letitia Turner recently. However, he has expressed to us that the medication he is currently on, he doesn't feel like it's working as well as other medication he's been on in the past, Kenvell said. The state represented by First Assistant County Attorney Ryan Baldridge had no objection to the waiver, and it was accepted by Doyle. Russell still has the right to withdraw his waiver of a speedy trial at any time, Doyle noted. The court has set August 10th as the new start date for Russell's murder trial. Russell had been previously remanded to the Iowa Medical and Classification Center at Oakdale in Coralville for an evaluation and any necessary treatment to restore the defendant to competency to face trial. Defense attorney Kenvell had requested a competency hearing for Russell in February 2020, citing that the defendant had been exhibiting signs of paranoia and hallucinations consistent with schizophrenia. Former Chief District Judge Kurt Wilkie ordered Russell to be evaluated at the IMCC. At a hearing in May prompted by positive psychiatric evaluations and the establishment of a medication regimen, Doyle found Russell had been restored to competency with treatment and ordered proceedings to resume. Weather permitting on Monday, beginning on Monday after 7:30 a.m., and until work is completed, the warehouse division will be testing water valves on 1st Avenue North between North 12th Street and North 15th Street, and North 15th Street between Central Avenue and 1st Avenue North. During this operation, you may experience discoloration of water, and any disruption should be short-lived. If you experience any issues, please call the water department at 573-7156 to file a report. Taking a look at from our files, March 2006, there's a picture of Louis Bach along with his wife Linda. He holds a photograph of himself from when he started with the Fort Dodge Police Department in February 1977. Fellow members of the Fort Dodge Police Department built this back porch and ramp shown in the picture while Bach recovered from injuries he sustained in a motorcycle accident. The police sergeant died on June 5, 2020 without returning to work. Drive Your Tractor to School Day was held recently. There are a handful of John Deere tractors parked in the parking lot at Manson Northwest Webster High School. The picture shows Carter Moline, age 16, from Manson, and a sophomore at Manson Northwest Webster, and he visits with classmate Joe Corti, also 16, of Palmer, about some of the features of his John Deere 9630T after school on Friday. Tractors are all lined up outside the school. That's kind of funny. The Fort Dodge Police Department is investigating reports of multiple gunshots fired in the 1400 block of 5th Avenue North Thursday morning. According to a release from the department, the Webster County Telecommunications Center received a call of shots fired at about 6:25 a.m. It was unknown whether anyone had been struck. Officers arrived on scene and found evidence that shots had been fired in the area of 1408 5th Avenue North and spoke with several individuals in the area to determine what happened. The officers also found property damage on the residence that was consistent with gunfire. Fort Dodge PD is continuing to investigate this incident and encourages anyone who may have heard or seen anything to contact the department at 573-2323. Nearby residents with security cameras are encouraged to send any video footage to the department as well. Fort Dodge Police Department was assisted by the Webster County Sheriff's Department. The Webster County Health Department held its largest COVID-19 mass vaccination clinic yet Thursday, with plans to only make it bigger soon as vaccine production ramps up dramatically. The Health Department vaccinated 1,770 people with their first dose at Crossroads Mall, dwarfing its last clinic that delivered about 700 shots. Director Kerry Prescott said the organization of the March 7th clinic impressed Governor Kim Reynolds so much that it secured this week's extra vaccines for the county. Prescott delivered details of the county's organization at Reynolds' press conference in Des Moines Wednesday, where the governor praised it as a model for the rest of the state to emulate. Using three pods, Webster County Health Department is able to coordinate hundreds of shots each hour and coordinate vaccines from multiple manufacturers, which have different instructions for preparation and use between storage and the arm. Together, the pods on Thursday were able to vaccinate 300 people per hour. Soon, Prescott would like it to take it 500 people per hour. She said a similar model was used for H1N1 vaccinations, but had to be modified to accommodate the 15-minute wait time required for those receiving a COVID-19 vaccine. Thursday's mass vaccination was also the first time the health department juggled more than one vaccine manufacturer. Prescott told Reynolds Wednesday that Webster County is ready and willing to take on a third manufacturer's vaccine. When the capacity of the mall gets maxed out with chairs, the mass vaccination clinic's hours could be extended. The health department could also open other locations simultaneously. The next article is entitled, Continuing to Treat Fort Dodge. The day after Steve Springer, Fort Dodge was diagnosed with esophageal cancer in March 2020. He shared a brief conversation with his son, Shay, about Snack Shack Treats and Eats. He told me we need to get the Snack Shack open, Shay recalled, as the two sat and watched TV together at Mary Greeley Medical Center in Ames. I said, I've got no problem selling ice cream cones. His father just looked at him and smiled. He knew we were behind him 100%, Shay said. Eventually, Shay would take on a much larger role at the ice cream shop much sooner than he anticipated. Steve Springer founded the Snack Shack in April 2017. It is located at 1601 Central Avenue. Many people came to know him through his volunteer work behind the concession stand at Dodger Athletic events, and that love of serving others and seeing the smiles of people enjoying a snack eventually motivated him to open the ice cream shop. It kind of all started when he did the concession stand to help the Dodgers, said Julie Springer, the widow of Steve. Everyone knew him as the concessions guy, and he didn't get paid a cent. It was clear that Steve Springer was passionate about serving others. He always had new ideas, Shay said. He brought in the warm, fresh-baked cookies and the Dodger dogs. He liked food service and coming up with ideas. Julie was a little surprised the night Steve came home to tell her he was going to open an ice cream shop. He was really good friends with Joe Harvey, who owned the building. He walked in here one night and said, "Let's do this." With local recipes and suppliers for the food and wide variety of ice cream flavors, it didn't take long for the shack to gain popularity in Fort Dodge. It was one of the things he talked about, Julie said. He loved Wonton Inn, former Fort Dodge resident back in the day, and he used that same recipe for his wontons. Steve loved local recipes and buying local ingredients. The shack burgers, known as loose meat sandwiches and shack dogs or conies, are other items on the Snack Shack menu inspired by past Fort Dodge residents. There's a lot of deep-rooted local recipes, Shay said. The business took off. He was good at it. Between his work as vice president of mortgage loans at Avella Bank, the Snack Shack, and cooking for family and friends, Steve didn't leave a lot of downtime for himself. Looking back, both Shay and Julie wonder how he got it all done. I don't know how he did it, Julie said. He bought this and did so much himself. He spent so many hours here, he didn't expect us to know that much. After he became ill, Steve started teaching Shay many of the skills it requires to open the operate the business. Steve would sit on a stool inside the shack and talk Shay through the various processes. With the help of a strong staff, the shack opened successfully in the spring of 2020, although many would say it wasn't quite the same without Steve's presence as he continued to battle the disease. Steve would still venture in to do what work he could, but as the weeks went by, his health continued to decline. As things progressed, I wanted to learn more and more because he couldn't do certain things and was becoming aware that things were getting worse, Shay said. Shay could tell his father appreciated his willingness to learn. Even when he was super sick, he enjoyed teaching me things, and he was glad I was taking an interest, Shay said. He was excited. I wanted to be a part of it. He did teach Shay different stuff than he knew I already did, said Julie. He taught Shay more physical stuff. Even through his illness, Steve Springer had a difficult time not wanting to be at the shack helping. I had to start hiding the keys, Julie said. In May, the community rallied around the Springer family. Customers purchased Springer Strong bracelets. And on May 17, Steve Springer's 1979 St. Edmund Catholic School classmates organized a parade of cars to drive by his home on North 19th Street to show their support. Hundreds of family, friends, and co-workers cruised by with signs and honks of encouragement. Days later, Steve passed away with family by his side on May 31, 2020. And although he's no longer with them, his values live on with his family. He taught us to give back, Shay said. He was always concerned about others. Giving back to the community, he did that in everything he did. Julie recalled the nights that Steve would drive around the city after the shack closed and look for people who needed help. He would drive out after it closed and give people cash. He was an anonymous and generous giver. Some people needed help, and he had no problem helping people. He knew that anyone could find themselves at any part of life. You could be down bad and hurting and didn't do anything to get yourself there. After Steve's passing, many wondered about the future of the business he worked so hard to grow. His number one thing was family. The next thing was the shack, Shay said. He loved it. So Julie, owner, and Shay Springer, the operator, are forging ahead to keep the business going 1 year after his passing. He would be happy to see us keep it going, said Julie, who also works as the school nurse at Cooper Elementary. Shay works as a Fort Dodge firefighter. The station is located directly across the street from the snack shack. He's been a firefighter for almost 3 years. It's a physical challenge just as much as mental, Shay said. I love exercising and being in shape and being healthy. The other thing is you always have a set schedule so you know what you're going into that day. But at the same time, you have a number of calls that can come in during the shift. You never get bored. It's never stagnant. There's always something to learn. He described the department as his second family. The 24-hour shifts allow him the flexibility of working at the shack. I love my job there, Shay said. I am grateful for the way the schedule is that I'm able to work here. Wontons were one item missing from the menu for most of the summer of 2020. That's because Steve Springer always made those. One of the big things is the wontons are back this year. It's hard because you have to roll hundreds and they only last a few days in the fridge, said Shay. Julie said plenty of customers have asked about them. Nobody gave up asking last year. Shay recommends calling ahead if planning to order more than 24. The pizza burger, shack dog, shack burgers, and chicken strips are among the other food options. In terms of ice cream, the menu includes 12 flavors with weekly special flavors on rotation. The 8 regular flavor burst flavors include peanut butter, root beer, bubblegum, strawberry, cotton candy, green apple, black raspberry, and butter pecan. The Lorita's Razzle is a local favorite. That includes frosting from Lorita's Cakes and more. The Caramel Apple Sundae is another popular treat. Over 30 people are on the list to work at the shack over the spring and summer. Many are high school or college students. We like to give high school students and early college students a chance to learn some adult skills, said Julie. We like kids involved in sports and community activities. Those are good kids, and we have a lot returning from last year. Shay's brothers, Sean and Sawyer, supported the business as well. Sean works full-time at Midwest Medical Rides. Sawyer is a senior at Fort Dodge Senior High. He is active in sports and other extracurricular activities. Shay and Julie are looking forward to seeing friends drop by for a treat this summer. My mom and I are super honored we can continue this place. The entire goal is to support the community. Steve just liked people to smile. He said ice cream cones make people smile. The snack shack will open for the season on April 1st. Regular hours are 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Friday. The shack will be open from noon to 9 on Saturday and Sunday. You're listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. And now we will take a look at the obituary page. Samuel Hovey. Samuel A. Hovey, 82, of Mackinac, Illinois, died Tuesday, March 16th in Morton, Illinois. His gentle, infectious smile will be missed by all who knew and loved him. Sam was born August 29, 1938, in Fort Dodge to Samuel and Martha Johnson Hovey. He married Mary E. Wheat October 26, 1958, in Fort Dodge. She survives. Also surviving are three children, Jody Schaefer, Jill Wester, Chad Hovey, 10 grandchildren, Aaron Braun, Amanda Schaefer, Andrew Schaefer, Emily Schaefer, Andrea Wilson, Curtis Wester, Eric Wester, Sarah Andrews, Matthew Hovey, Samantha Hovey, 5 great-grandchildren, 1 sister, Marjorie Bruland, 1 sister-in-law, Bernice Hovey. He was preceded in death by his parents, 1 sister, Thora Olson, 3 brothers, Conrad, Sherman, and James. Sam graduated from Fort Dodge Senior High School in 1956 and Waldorf College in 1958. He worked at Badger Co-op Elevator from 1958 through 1966. From 1966 through 1972, Sam was manager of Summers Co-op Elevator. He continued his career as the manager of Forest City Co-op Elevator from 1972 to 1982. In 1982, he joined Forest City Bank and Trust in the Farm Loan Department. Until 1984, Sam was the bank president and CEO at First Security Bank in Mackinac, Illinois from 1984 through 2003. He was a member of the Advent Lutheran Church and Mackinac Lions Club. Cremation rights will be accorded with Hansel Funeral Home in Mackinac, Illinois, in charge of arrangements. Burial will be at North Lawn Cemetery at a later date. Family would like to thank the staff at Reflections Memory Care and Transitions Hospice Care for the care given to Sam. Memorials may be made to Advent Lutheran Church in Morton, Illinois, or the Mackinac Rescue Squad in Mackinac, Illinois. David Sundin. David L. C. Sundin, 64, of McDonough, Georgia, died Thursday, March 18th. David was born Saturday, December 8, 1956, in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, to the late Richard Kirk and Mrs. Annette Marie Rose Racine Carlson. Along with his father, David is preceded in death by his grandson, Maverick Christopher Sundin. He was the former owner of Moore's Brothers Paving, Moore Brothers Paving, a hard worker, and had a fierce, loving heart. David loved spending time with his family and wife, especially his grandchildren. He enjoyed playing racquetball, pickleball, and spending time outdoors. He will be missed by his beloved German Shepherd River. David is survived by his wife of 40 years, Deborah, children Christopher and Natalie Sundin, Paige Sundin, Amber Jennings, grandchildren Jace Channing, Scarlett Dale, Crew Blakely, mother and stepfather Annette and Ron Carlson, brothers and sisters-in-law Kevin and Joan Sundin, Wade and Lee Sundin, sister and brother-in-law Cindy and Mike Moore, mother-in-law Sharon Moore, several nieces and nephews. Celebration of life for David Sundin was held March 21st at the Indian Springs Amphitheater in Flovilla, Georgia. Friends may visit, a private entombment will follow, with family requesting donations to a charity of the donor's choice. Cheryl Westbury Funeral Home in Jackson, Georgia is serving the family. John Vesey. Jonathan John Lee Vesey died at age 69 on March 13th in Daytona Beach, Florida, surrounded by family members. John was born December 5th, 1951, in South Dakota, to the Reverend Robert G. and Helen L. McConnell Vesey. He taught English at Fort Dodge Senior High and also advised radio club and video technology from 1979 through 2009. He operated a part-time business called Personal Memories Video. Survivors are Mary Frederick, brother David Vesey, nephews Luke Frederick and Ty Frederick, great-nephew Ryder Frederick, great-niece Roxy Frederick, an aunt Ruth McConnell, several cousins, and many faithful friends. He was preceded in death by his parents, his aunt and uncle Dorothy and Bill McKay, his aunt Betty McConnell, aunt and uncle Randy and Sue Randall, and his uncle Tom McConnell. Steve Larson. Steve Larson, 69, of Fort Dodge, died February 28th at Trinity Regional Medical Center. Private family burial service will take place at 2 o'clock Wednesday, March 24th at North Lawn Cemetery. Close friends are welcome to attend. Gunderson Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Burnside, Joyce McClelland. Joyce McClelland, born in February 1944, died January 4th, 2021, in Edina, Minnesota. She also lived in Mesa, Arizona, New London, Minnesota, and Burnside. She died peacefully, surrounded by family after a long, courageous battle with cancer. Celebration of life service is pending. And that looks to be the extent of today's obituary page. Head back to the news section. Let's take a look next at the news of record from March 20th. Fort Dodge police logs on Thursday include one domestic report, hit and run at 1st Avenue South, South 25th Street. Suspicious person reported on Williams Drive, a fight in the 10 block of North 7th Street. Suspicious vehicle, 800 block North 7th Street. Suspicious person, North 26th Street and Elmer's Avenue. Shots fired, 1400 block 5th Avenue North. Suspicious person, 100 block South 12th Street. Juvenile problems, 1200 block 4th Avenue North. Burglary in progress, 1300 block 4th Avenue South. Shoplifter, 200 block South 25th Street. Suspicious person, 100 block of North 29th Street. Criminal mischief, 1200 block 4th Avenue North. Trespassing, 2700 block North 14th Street. A fight in the 3100 block of 5th Avenue South. Suspicious person, 1300 block 3rd Avenue Northwest. Car accident, 170th Street and Madison Avenue. Theft in the 600 block of North 12th Street. An assault in the 100 block of Avenue O West. Suspicious vehicles in the 10 block of South 25th Street and the 200 block of South 25th Street. A fight in the 1600 block of 4th Avenue South. Magistrate court on Friday, assault two counts, Allison Arklin. 18 of Fort Dodge, 5 days suspended for each count, $60 fine for each count, parole violation. Christopher Begtall, 40 of Duncombe, transferred to the parole board. Driving while barred, two counts, Joey Gill, 37 of Fort Dodge, preliminary hearing set for March 26. Fifth degree theft, Valerie Kintoff, 60 of Fort Dodge, hearing set for April 9. Interference with official acts, Vincent Calcedias, 26 of Illinois, fined $347.50. Failure to appear, Angel Williams Gutierrez, 19 of Sioux City, transferred to district court. From our files takes us next to the report from Friday's newspaper. Magistrate court, operating while intoxicated, second offense, driving while barred, and possession of marijuana, all charges against Chad Wilson of Farnhamville. Preliminary hearing waived on the marijuana charge and driving while barred, along with operating while intoxicated, second offense. Second degree criminal mischief, public intoxication, and disorderly conduct, Raymond Martin, 43 of Fort Dodge, 180 days continuation on the conduct and intoxication charge, preliminary hearing set for the second degree criminal mischief. Fifth degree criminal mischief, Katie Lucas of Mason City, hearing set for April 9th. Assault causing injury, understanding Bourne Marshall, preliminary hearing set for March 26. Reckless driving, leaving the scene of an accident, assault with a dangerous weapon, Austin Sheeker of Fort Dodge. Preliminary hearing waived on the dangerous weapon charge. Leaving the scene of an accident, reckless driving, both continued 180 days. Fort Dodge police logs from Wednesday reported two domestic calls, a noise disturbance, 3100 block 16th Avenue North. Hit and run, 800 block North 25th Street. Prowler, 17th Avenue North and North 29th Street. Criminal mischief, 1000 block South 18th Street. An assault in 800 block of Central Avenue and the 2000 block of Highland Park Avenue. Nuisance, 2200 block second and a half Avenue North. Harassment in the 100 block of South 18th Street. An assault in the 10 block of Triton Circle. Car accident in the 5th Avenue South and South 15th Street area. Hit and run in the 1300 block of 3rd Avenue Northwest. And a shoplifter in the 3000 block of 1st Avenue South. That would be the police logs and magistrate court report for the past few days or so. Let's go ahead and click on the lifestyle section. And we'll see what awaits us there. And I usually click on weddings and anniversaries. Let's start with that, or birthdays and anniversaries, I mean, is what I intended to say. Bill and Lelani Schlick, Bill and Leilani Schlick of Fort Dodge will celebrate their 50th wedding anniversary. There's a nice picture of the happy couple. They were married on March 20th, and they will have a celebration of their 50th wedding anniversary at a later date. Jane Pearson. Jane Pearson will celebrate her 95th birthday on Thursday. Her family includes Janice Gappa and Galen and Chris Pearson, Deanna and Larry Rohrer, and son-in-law Jerry Cormack. She has 6 grandchildren, 10 great-grandchildren. Her husband Gail and daughter Paulette Cormack are both deceased. Jane was born March 25, 1926 in Fort Dodge. She worked as a medical records transcriptionist at Trinity Regional Hospital for many years, and she and her husband farmed. And that looks to be the only anniversaries or birthdays that we have for this week. I'm going to click on arrivals and see if there have been any arrivals that have arrived recently. We'll start with Iowa Specialty Hospital. That's the only one they have for us this week. Andrea and Michael McLaughlin. Andrea and Michael McLaughlin of Clarion welcomed a girl named Celia Joy McLaughlin, born February 11th. Grandparents are John and Becky Aronson, Brian and Marie McLaughlin. Great-grandparents are Ensign Leninger and Joan McLaughlin. And that is the only birth announcement in the newspaper this week. The next article is entitled Celebrating National Ag Week. For the past 40-plus years, one day has been set aside to recognize and celebrate the abundance provided by American agriculture. National Ag Day is organized by the Agriculture Council of America. The ACA is a nonprofit organization composed of leaders in the agriculture, food, and fiber community, dedicating its efforts to increasing the public's awareness of agriculture's role in modern society. The National Ag Day program encourages every American to understand how food and fiber products are produced, appreciate the role agriculture plays in providing safe and abundant and affordable products, value the essential role of agriculture in maintaining a strong economy, acknowledge and consider career opportunities in the agriculture, food, and fiber industry day. National Ag Day is celebrated near the first day of spring each year. Those observances range from local businesses, organizations, and schools recognizing the day up to large gatherings in Washington, D.C. Jennifer Pickett, Executive Vice President and CEO of the National Agri-Marketing Association, the entity which manages National Ag Day, said they are making adjustments to virtually celebrate the 48th anniversary of National Ag Day this year. March 23rd, National Ag Day will be celebrated by bringing approximately 100 college students to Washington, D.C. virtually to help deliver the message of Ag Day to Capitol Hill. Pickett said this will be quite different from the in-person events held in years past. Usually we would celebrate Ag Day in Washington, D.C. That would be kind of our national press push. And so that last few years we have convened at USDA or National Press Club to put on a program that appealed to media and the ag industry. An agricultural reception would also be held on Capitol Hill for the staff and other agricultural industry people in Washington, which included several commodity groups that would typically be meeting in Washington, D.C. during National Ag Week. Also, in the past, 100 college students comprised of FFA, 4-H, and AFA were also brought to the nation's capital to be included in National Ag Day events. The students would come from all over the country, Pickett said. They would have a day or so of message training where we would give them the tools to then carry the message of Ag Day to the Hill, where they had scheduled visits with members of Congress. Pickett said the National Ag Day website offers a variety of resources for use in print, online, and in other media. We have different audiences that we try to appeal to. On our website, we have lots of food tools and resources that will assist grassroots groups, local farm bureaus, or even down to the local bank that want to plan an Ag Day event. That is one audience. The other is for educational purposes. We also have a portion of our website that is dedicated to teachers and giving them ideas and helpful things they can do. ACA is a nonprofit organization comprised of leaders in the agriculture, food, and fiber community. dedicating its efforts to increasing the public's awareness of agriculture roles in modern society. We rely entirely on sponsorship and donations. Our money comes from ag companies, producer groups, and even marketing agencies. They are all people that feel passionate about emphasizing the importance of National Ag Day and having a day to celebrate agriculture. Locally, the FFA chapters at Manson Northwest Webster and Southeast Valley are taking part in the celebration of National Ag Week and National Ag Day. Doug Dahl, FFA advisor for Manson Northwest Webster, said they are planning on a Drive Your Tractor to School Day, which we referenced earlier, to celebrate National Ag Day. By doing this, not only is it fun for kids to showcase their tractors for the day, they use the opportunity to raise awareness of agriculture. It makes a statement when you see an entire line of tractors driving down the road and parked in the school parking lot. One of the goals of FFA is to strengthen agriculture, so this is just our way of drawing attention to it. Gall said they have been celebrating the event for about 10 years now, on or near National Ag Day. We are an agricultural community, yet still many people in the community take for granted the value and impact of agriculture. We take it seriously. It's our job to prepare the future of agriculture, and this is a fun way to show that young people are excited for the opportunities that are out there in the industry. Steve Kehoe, the FFA advisor for Southeast Valley Schools, said that they have been partaking in advertising in support of National Ag Day and are also planning a Drive Your Tractor or pickup to school day. In addition, Kehoe said they are having a special ag-related dress-up day at school with treats for those participating. When Kehoe said he asked his FFA and agricultural education students why they choose to celebrate National Ag Day, he said they all agreed it is to, quote, demonstrate and make the student body and staff aware how many families are involved with agriculture in this school district. And I referenced a couple of pictures in the paper earlier about National Ag Day. I noticed that they have all the red tractors parked together and the green tractors parked together in various sizes and shapes and things like that. And it looks like, from one other item I saw, they had about 17 tractors driven for National Ag Day at Manson Northwest Webster. So that makes for a pretty special day for those kids. Let's head over to the sports section and see what awaits us there. We're in between seasons now that basketball is all done and wrestling is all done. Brody Teske and Tristan Lara proved just how close they are in their respective performances at the 2021 NCAA Championships in wrestling this week. The former Fort Dodge Senior High state champions also saw firsthand what kind of work still needs to be done in order to obtain All-American status moving forward. Teske and Lehrer were eliminated from contention Friday for the University of Northern Iowa as both suffered heartbreaking losses in matches that it could have gone either way. Leading 2-0 with less than 20 seconds remaining in regulation, 5th-seeded Teske was caught from behind by number 4-seed Drew Hildebrandt of Central Michigan in the quarterfinal round. Hildebrandt set the match to sudden victory with a late takedown, then scored another takedown to advance to the semifinal round with a 4-2 triumph. Hildebrand lost to two-time defending national champion Spencer Lee of Iowa in the semis by a score of 11-0. Needing a victory to secure All-American status, Teske was ousted in the consolation round by number 15 seed Patrick McKee of Minnesota by a score of 9-2. Teske, a four-time Fort Dodger gold medalist as a prep, scored a pair of victories on Thursday over Brandon Kaler of Oregon State and Northwestern's Michael D'Agostino to reach the Elite Eight at 125. Teske's redshirt sophomore year concludes with an overall record of 14-3. It's all a learning process, a very humbling one, Teske said. One foot in front of the other. Life goes on and 365 days goes quick. I will be back and better. I'm always on the hunt for who I have not yet become. Grateful that the opportunity even existed and just thankful for all the support. Lara, seated 23rd at 149 pounds, defeated number 10 Michael Van Brill of Rutgers in his national debut on Thursday. He suffered a crushing 9-8 setback to John Milner of Appalachian State, though leaving the two-time Fort Dodge Senior High champ in a make-or-break mode for Friday's blood rounds. Lara fell to 8th seed Jaden Abbas of Stanford It was the eighth loss by decision in as many setbacks for the redshirt junior in 2021. "It burns a lot, I won't lie," said Lara, "but I know I have family and friends who love me, so it's all good. I know I'm right there with some of the best guys. It's time to put my head down and get back to work. I have to get a lot better this offseason. I just want to send a huge thank you to everyone back home supporting us. It means a ton and definitely keeps us going." Teske and Lara were the first two Division I national qualifiers from Fort Dodge since Mark Ryle punched his ticket for the Panthers in 2001 at 141 pounds. Parker Keckinson secured All-American status at 184 pounds by reaching the semis for UNI. He scored a 4-2 victory against number 5 Hunter Bolin of Virginia Tech before being edged in the semis by top-seeded Aaron Brooks of Penn State, 6-4. Keckinson was to place no worse than 6th. We'll take a quick look at the Messenger editorial page. Grant Support Child Care Projects in Fort Dodge is the title of the editorial. As the Fort Dodge community continues to struggle with a shortage of available child care openings, it received some welcome news recently. Iowa Workforce Development has awarded more than $1 million in grants to support a couple of local child care projects. Those grants won't close the needs gap in a community in which there are 1,743 spaces available in child care programs for more than 4,600 kids needing such care. One of the grants will help an existing child care center relocate, thus staying in business and preventing the child care crunch from getting worse. The other grant will help an existing child care provider expand and add 56 more spaces for kids. Child Care Discovery received $734,000+ to help its effort to build a new facility near 14th Avenue North and 32nd Street. It has been located for decades in a strip mall on 1st Avenue South, which was bought last year and appears likely to be demolished. The new building will consist of 16,400 square feet on one level, serving up to 250 children. Community Early Childhood Center at South 24th Street has received a $330,600 grant to pay for equipment and furnishings needed for an addition. Plans call for adding 4 rooms to the existing building. It is good to see local efforts being made to preserve our existing child care capacity and add to it. We are also pleased that officials at Iowa Workforce Development have seen the need in our community and are making some grant money available to help. Despite these signs of progress, quality child care remains an urgent need and must remain a priority for local leaders. And that is the Messenger editorial. There's a letter to the editor, and this letter was submitted by Jeremy Swanson of Humboldt. To the editor, March 22nd through the 26th is National Ag Week. When we celebrate the wholesome contributions of our nation's farmers, who provide the food, fuel, and fiber that helps sustain us. American agriculture is the foundation of our country. It is the backbone of a healthy and prosperous nation, made possible by our natural resources and soils, climate, ingenuity, and technology. Today's farmers are far more efficient than ever thanks to precision agriculture, GPS, improved seed genetics, and the like. As Americans, we enjoy the safest, most affordable food supply in the world, leaving us with more disposable income to spend on household expenses, travel, and non-essential luxury items. Perhaps forgotten in all this is the economic contribution agriculture provides to our local economy. According to the 2017 Census of Agriculture in Webster County, agriculture and ag-related industries provide 5,200 jobs for approximately 22% of all employment in the county. In other, more non-rural counties, the percentage of employment is much greater. So the next time you sit down to enjoy a meal, drive your car, or put on a pair of blue jeans, remember the farmer who made it all possible. And that was submitted by Jeremy Swanson. I'm sorry, I think I said he was from Humboldt. He is from Harcourt. And that is a letter to the editor in today's Messenger. Let's take a look at the weather forecast as our time together is drawing to a close. We're going to see some rain on Monday. 100% chance of rain is what they're saying, with a high of 53 degrees, winds northeast at 10 miles per hour with gusts to 19. 100% chance of rain tomorrow night, Monday night, high of or low of 45. Tuesday, rain likely, again 100% chance of rain, high temperature of 57 degrees. Tuesday night, rain continues, but the chances lower a little bit. 80% chance of rain, and the winds drop down a little bit, along with the low temperature of 39 degrees. Wednesday, cloudy, mostly cloudy skies, a 20% chance of precipitation, and a high temperature of 52. Wednesday night, a low of 32 degrees. Thursday, a high of 53. Under partly cloudy skies, Thursday night, a low of 31 degrees. On Friday, partly cloudy skies, high of 53 degrees. Friday night, a low of 35. Saturday, partly cloudy, high of 57. Slight chance of precipitation. Partly cloudy skies, Saturday night, a low of 34. And on Sunday, a high of 52 degrees under partly cloudy skies with winds 14 to 24 miles per hour. So it's going to rain for a couple of days or so, and then once we get through that, we won't have a lot of extra sunshine, but we'll have some, so that should help things just a little bit. In the meantime, that's going to bring us to the end of the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for this past weekend. Kevin Rogers at the microphone. I had to stop and think what my name is. We appreciate your continued support of IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. Of course, this podcast and many others are available to you at iowaradioreading.org. They have several other newspapers there that you may listen to as well. And as I said, we appreciate your continued support of IRIS. Look forward to visiting with you again real soon. In the meantime, stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll talk to you again here on IRIS. Bye-bye for now.